Yes, sir. Good old Valentine tank right there. That looks like a Mark III or two or
Four.
that a Mark IV. Okay. So why the fuck do they use the same goddamn turret? You know what? Never mind. It's a podcast episode.
You're gonna find out. You're gonna find out.
I'm gonna.
I think that might just be a cold open for that one.
that would actually make a very cold open.
All right, shall we kick this shit off, shall we?
Let's kick it off, brother.
Well, welcome to the Micro Machines Podcast. This is the second episode for Season 4. Can you believe it? 4 years and going strong.
Brother, that's a whole enlistment in the Marine Corps. That's crazy.
I know, that's weird, eh? It's like that's like most of high school. That's also, it's like the fourth year of the old Ukraine-Russia going on. You know that? Because that
kicked
off like a week before we started doing this podcast.
God, that's crazy.
I know, right? When you think about it, it was all supposed to be a short conflict. It's still going on. Then again, Hitler also thought the same thing about World War II.
Yes.
Anyway, speaking of World War II, we'll be looking at a World War II tank, specifically the British Valentine Tank series, a rather iconic tank in its own right, and also, in my opinion, one of the best-looking tanks. I got to say, it's just a very cool-looking vehicle. But before we get into anything like that, we need to do our usual introductions. So there's just the two of us this week. So you have me, Callum, in New Zealand, currently sipping on a coffee because I've just woken up.
Then you got me, Garrison, out here in Kansas, middle of buttfuck nowhere. I'm sipping on a White Monster because I work to buy White Monsters, and I buy White Monsters to work, get on my level. Working on a T-64 and super pumped for this Valentine episode because I've recently fallen in love with the Valentine. So
you have seen the light of the Valentine.
I have.
All right, so let's jump straight into it. But first, before we do anything, we need to find out just how the Valentine turned up before we start going into any of the variants. So the origin and development. Following the A-11 Matilda 1 and the A-2 and the A-12 Matilda 2, two tanks we will definitely be looking at some point in the future.
Next
logical step might have been the A-13. However, the transition never occurred. Instead, development began on what would become the Valentine tank, remarkably without an official War Office specification. They just decided to build it. They just went, fuck it, we want to build a tank. You know, back in the day when you could just do that, like, I'm going to build a tank.
Love that.
Initiated as a private venture by Sir John Carden, the design was submitted to British authorities on February 10th, 1938. By that time, the Matilda II had already been selected for production, but the Valentine represented a distinct approach. Vickers engineers aimed to improve upon their earlier A-10 cruiser tank by significantly boosting its armor protection, up to 60 millimeters or 2.36 inches, which at the time is a decent amount of armor.
Hey, that's above average. If you're...
Well, to be honest, especially at the start of the war, a lot of the French and British armor, the tanks, had significantly more armor than the Germans did. I mean, when you're looking at Panzer IIs, Panzer IIIs, the early ones especially, they were rolling with maybe 20 mil at most. Of armor, maybe 30 on an angle, but they had barely any armor at the start of it. Whereas, you know, you got Valentine's, you got Matilda's, even the Matilda 1 had 60 to 65 millimeters of armor on the front, and it's a small tank.
You know, small tank, big package, you know.
Yeah, I mean, even the French tanks had a lot of armor. Everyone has a weird World War II theory, right?
Yeah.
My theory is if the Germans didn't have the 88 millimeter flak during the French campaign, they would have been stalled a lot longer, and it might have been different. the results might have been different. Well, I mean, you know, they got stalled out by B1s and Samoas, as well as Matildas and stuff like that, because they couldn't knock them out. It wasn't until they actually brought the 88 millimeter flak to start shooting at them that they actually started doing something.
Brother, I want to see what a fucking flak 88 does to anything.
Ah, like, there's photos.
With my own eyes. Well, I know the photos, but like, I want to watch this bitch shoot around, and then I want to drive down range and see it in real time.
This decision enabled the continued use of many components from the Cruiser 1 and 2, resulting in a cost-effective and efficient design solution for producing a new infantry tank. In contrast, the Matilda 2, while more capable than its predecessor, proved too expensive and complex for mass production. The Valentine offered a more practical balance between protection, cost, and manufacturability. The origin of the name Valentine remains uncertain, as it may have derived from Sir John Carden's middle name, the date of the design submission, close to St. Valentine's Day, or possibly from a vicar's internal code name. Most historians believe it was simply a developmental code name that stuck. The Valentine's lower hull was largely derived from the earlier A9 and A10 cruiser tank designs. It retained the same engine, transmission, drivetrain, steering system, tracks, and road wheels. However, the upper hull was redesigned to be lower in profile, and the newly developed turret was both more compact and reduced in height. The result was a compact, if somewhat cramped, vehicle that was easier to armor effectively. While its armor was 20 millimeters thinner than that of the Matilda 2, it is still comparable to that of the Matilda 1 and significantly superior to the armor found on contemporary German tanks, such as the Panzer III and Panzer IV. Armament remained standard for British tanks of the period. The quick-firing 2-pounder Mark III, which was already widely used across British armoured units, though increasingly seen as underpowered. One issue raised by the War Office was the two-man turret, which required the commander to also serve as gunner and loader. A three-man turret was preferred to allow the commander to focus solely on command duties. However, with war clearly on the horizon in 1939, urgency took precedence. The design was approved in April in exchange for an accelerated production timeline. Vickers received an order by the end of that year, with the highest priority and a target for initial deliveries in May 1940. Despite this aggressive schedule, the only prototype was still undergoing trials by the deadline. Meanwhile, the evacuation at Dunkirk had left Britain critically short of armoured vehicles, because, you know, they couldn't take it with them. As a result, the Valentine entered mass production immediately, without the usual pilot or pre-production series, under its official designation Tank Infantry Mark III. The Valentine featured a straightforward internal layout, divided into three clearly defined compartments: the driver's compartment at the front, the fighting compartment in the centre, and the engine compartment at the rear. The transmission was compact, directly linked to the rear-mounted drive sprockets, which helped maintain the tank's low profile. Another thing to also point out, if you'll see on the drive sprocket on the back here, you see how that you have this little protrusion sticking out of the wheel hub?
Yep.
Do you know what that is?
I don't, but I did notice it the other day, and I was really curious about it.
That's the brakes.
No shit.
The brake drum is on the outside of the tank, on the outside of the wheel, not internally. It does have an armor plating around it, so it does offer some protection, but, you know, a well-placed shot will render your brake system scrap metal.
Tally-ho, lads!
But at the same time, from a mechanical standpoint, especially for, you know, tank mechanics and maintenance, it's a dream. You know, you just take off this... You undo about 20 bolts, take off the hub, and you've got full access to the brake drums. The driver sat centrally at the front, with control levers and clutches operating via long control rods, running the length of the hull to the gearbox at the rear. For visibility, he was equipped with a direct vision port and two periscopes, offering decent peripheral awareness. Entry and exit was facilitated by two side hatches and a small emergency escape hatch located behind his seat. The early two-man turret had a simple cylindrical form constructed from rolled armor plates, with a squared-off mantlet housing at the front and a shallow rear turret basket. The main gun was mounted centrally between the gunner on the left and the commander on the right, who was also responsible for loading the weapon. In later models, beginning with the Mark III, the turret was redesigned to relocate the commander further to the rear, improving crew ergonomics. Several manufacturers were involved in Valentine production, including the original Vickers Armstrong plant, Birmingham Railway Carriage and Wagon Company, the Metropolitan Camel across three, and Metropolitan Camel across three facilities. In Canada, the Canadian Pacific Railway's Augusta shops in Montreal produced Valentines for Commonwealth forces. And we get on to the very first one, the Valentine Mark I. You'll see here a few differences, notably the tracks on this mark, on this very early Mark I. The tracks are different. You'll see they are narrower. What was that?
I was just saying they look very skinny.
Yeah, the tracks were very narrow on earlier models, which made them not so good on off-road. So eventually you'll notice they start having the grousers. Grouser type where it's widens just to give a bit more off-road floating, you could say.
That makes sense.
So the Valentine Mark I established the foundation for a series of 11 main variants and numerous sub-variants, and oh boy, the sub-variants. There are some good ones.
Yeah?
Oh yeah, there's one that is particularly crackhead energy, we'll say. Culminating in an impressive total of around 8,300 units produced. While its overall appearance remained consistent throughout the war, key elements such as armament, turret design, engine performance, and armor protection were steadily refined up to 1945. The Mark I was distinguished by its original two-man turret and standard quick-firing two-pounder. A coaxial Beza machine gun served as the secondary armament from the outset. Due to the cramped interior, the crew was limited to just three men, the commander multitasking as gun loader, machine gunner, and radio operator. Oh, that poor bastard.
Sounds like the French.
It's just when you got to focus on like four different things and trying to tell people what to do, you feel sorry for him.
Oh, dude, 100%.
Production was accelerated under wartime urgency, resulting in several initial issues that were addressed in the improved Mark II. The Mark I was powered by an AEG A189 petrol engine, producing only 135 horsepower, and featured a riveted hull. A total of 350 units were built, with many seeing combat in Libya, while others remained in Britain for training purposes. If you want to build a British Valentine tank Mark I, well, you have two decent options. There are a few non-decent options that I will not include. But the two main ones you have here, you have from Miniart in 35th scale, the British infantry tank Valentine Mark I comes with the transmission compartment parts, so if you want to have the transmission hatches open, as well as AFV Club with their Mark I, which also features the top-mounted Bren gun and its little weird travel system thingy it's got there. You see what I'm meaning, eh?
Yeah.
It's an AA gun mount, basically, with a Bren and a drum magazine, which, not gonna lie, kind of fuck with.
Yeah, with a drum mag, yeah.
Introduced in 1941, the Valentine Mark II saw production double to 700 units. By June of that year, the name Valentine was officially adopted for the series. This version featured a six-cylinder AEC A190 diesel engine, producing 131 horsepower. Although slightly lower in horsepower than its predecessor, the diesel offered greater torque and improved fuel efficiency. A significant enhancement was the addition of an external fuel tank mounted on the left side of the hull, an unusual configuration as rear-mounted auxiliary tanks were more typical. This side-mounted tank became a distinctive feature of the Valentine design and greatly extended the vehicle's operational range, as you can see here, and I do believe it was on a quick release, but I'm not too sure about it.
Honestly, I fucked with the side.
Sorry?
The side mount tank right there. It
It kind of adds a little bit of a character to it, we'll say.
Especially from a modeler's perspective, bro. Like, little fucking Henry over there trying to heal it up.
You need to speak up a bit. You're going quiet again.
God damn it.
Stop walking away from your mic, man.
Brother, it's in the same spot. But, yeah, I was just thinking, you know, little Henry there could be working on feeling up the side canister, and then he fucking, I don't know, looks at something, or checks on his tee, and spills a bunch of fuel everywhere. So from a modeler's perspective, that would be nice.
Yeah. Little quick for the Valentine is the exhaust runs forward and then exits out to the side here, just on the left-hand side as well.
Oh, yes.
Which you don't usually see a lot. Now, if you want to build a Mark II Valentine, you have a few more options. Of course, you have Mini Art again. They basically have done the entire, most of the Valentine line. So they have the Valentine II in 35th scale. You also have AFV Club with their Mark II. The Tamiya one, which I believe you have, Garrison.
Yes, I do.
So that one can be used as either a Mark II or a Mark IV, depending on which parts you use for it.
Or,
as well, yep.
Or you can get a conversion kit like I'm going to do. Make a Mark
III. Which we will talk about soon. Don't worry about that. And as well as Dragon, they have the British Mark III infantry tank. That one there, the Imperial series, and 35th, that is a Mark II that they are depicting as well. They just don't say it, but that's what it is. On to my favorite one. We have the Valentine Mark III and the Valentine Mark III CS, or Close Support. So, the Valentine Mark III was introduced in late 1941 and quickly became one of the most widely produced and operationally significant variants of the entire series. Its most notable advancement was the adoption of a newly designed turret, which featured a fully enclosed internal mantlet and a significantly enlarged turret basket. These changes provided the critical interior space necessary to accommodate a dedicated loader, finally relieving the commander of his previous multitasking burden as gunner, loader, and radio operator. This three-man turret configuration greatly improved combat efficiency and crew coordination. To offset the additional weight of the redesigned turret and enlarged fighting compartment, engineers reduced the thickness of the side armor from 60mm to 50mm. Despite this trade-off, the Valentine III retained excellent protection for its class and time, particularly across the frontal arc, where armor was prioritized. Armament remains centered around the quick-firing two-pounder, now upgraded to the Mark V variant, which featured improved performance and reliability. Although increasingly limited against newer enemy armor, the two-pounder was still effective in early North African engagements. A unique New Zealand modification involved rearming 18 Valentine Mark III tanks by replacing their standard two-pounder guns with 3-inch howitzers, salvaged from Matilda IV close support tanks. Basically, we stole them off the Australians. These modified Valentines were deployed in the Pacific Theatre, notably during the Battle of the Green Islands, during the Solomon Island campaign. The 3-inch howitzers proved much more effective at destroying bunkers and clearing out Japanese positions, owing to its larger, high-explosive round compared to the 2-pounder using only solid shot. Remarkably, they remained in service within New Zealand forces well into the 1950s.
Oh, no shit.
I mean, we didn't have much, so we'll kind of use what we got. When it turns basically into an assault gun, it still worked. And you'll see here two photos here representing two New Zealand Valentine tanks, one that has been restored and drives around somewhere in the Northern Ireland, I think. And in the top right, you have some of the close support Valentines. You'll see with the larger, they have a slightly different mantlet on it and a wider barrel. And you can see the New Zealand markings along here, which I have the decals for, I will say. One day I'll build a New Zealand Valentine.
Where'd you get the decals for that?
Bought them in Canberra. They're the Firestorm ones.
Yeah.
And here they are right now. So if you want to build a Mark III Valentine, well, you have a couple of options. First off, we have mini art again. This time, their box art is depicting a German captured Valentine. The Germans captured a lot of Valentines, actually. Turns out they quite like them as well. But that kit also includes a New Zealand one, two British, and I think there's one more in there. I think Soviet. With AFV Club, you have the Mark III. Also, with the Rotor trailer, which everyone, I'm sure, knows about, just how bad it was. If you ever want a real funny description of the Rotor trailer, look for David Fletcher on YouTube. He is very, very scathing about it, and it is hilarious to listen to. And, of course, if you only have, say, a Mark II or a Mark IV, but you want to convert it into a Mark III, just look up Firestorm. They have an upgrade conversion kit to turn a Mark II or Mark IV into a Mark III, replacing the turret. You get a metal barrel, and you get a ton of stowage, mainly designed around New Zealand troops. So you also need to get their decals. So if you want to make a New Zealand Valentine Mark III for the Pacific, you're looking for the New Zealand 3rd Division tank. I got the headquarters one, and it comes with all the markings, as you can see here. These decals also look really good. It also comes with Daimler Scout decals as well for a New Zealand Pacific Daimler car. So if I can find a Mark II Daimler Scout, I will definitely be doing that as well. The Valentine Mark IV was equipped with an American-made 138 horsepower GMC 6004 diesel engine paired with a US-manufactured transmission. Although this version had a slightly reduced operational range compared to earlier models, it was notably quieter and praised for its high reliability, making it well-suited for extended field operations. The Mark IV Valentine saw most of its operational use by the Soviets under the Lend-Lease program. The Soviets quite liked its low profile. The gun, not so much, but it was good for infantry support. It was very reliable as well mechanically, which they quite liked. And they were still using the Mark IV right up to 1944, 1945 for some of their lesser fronts, specifically the Second Baltic Front sort of area. So most Mark IVs you see, like this one here, has got Soviet markings on them and has painted it. But they were still painted the British, this weird British dark brown, khaki brown type, grey brown. I don't know how to explain it. And of course, the Soviets have their infamous Forbio green. But when they did get Valentine tanks, they just didn't bother to repaint them. So most of them are in the sort of British, we'll call it grey brown, and they just put their marking schemes on them. Next, we have the Valentine Mark V. The Mark V was essentially identical to the Mark III in layout and turret configuration, but was fitted with an American 138 horsepower GMC 6004 diesel engine and US-built transmission. If you want to build a Mark IV, you have a few options. Of course, you have the Tamiya one, as we said before. If you want to build AFV Club, have a Soviet Red Army version. If you really hate yourself, and I mean really hate yourself, Ark Models has a Valentine Mark IV.
Just get the Tamiya kit. Fuck.
I only paid $3 for the kit. Still overpaid for it. That it's shaped like a Valentine, but none of the parts go together. And it had massive sinkholes. I would avoid that one if all possible. And if you want to build a Valentine Mark V, Mini Art have the Mark V, which also comes with this really cool Italian or Sicilian campaign camouflage scheme. which looks really, really cool, I gotta say.
I would agree. I saw a guy on YouTube make that. It looked really cool.
How'd he do it? Just a lot of masking, or?
No, he actually hand brushed the green.
Jesus, and that's...
He said it was surprisingly relaxed, which I find hard to believe.
I know. Whenever I do that kind of stuff, I'm always just stressed. I'm like, and you know, especially on a curve, the brush just like flicks out for some reason.
Yep.
I'm just like that. No, I'd rather spend like a day masking that up than trying to do that. Oof.
Part of me wants to be like, I hate myself, and you know, go and actually hand paint that. But then that requires getting another Valentine, and I'm like, eh. I still have to build.
Up next, we have a whole bunch of Canadian Valentines. So I'm kind of lumping them together, the Mark 6, 7, and 7A. The Valentine Mark 6 and 7 were Canadian-produced variants derived from the British Mark 4, both featuring two-man turrets but incorporating numerous local modifications. Production was established in Canada in 1941 and ramped up significantly in 1942. These models increasingly used American and Canadian manufacturing components, reflecting local industry capabilities. Notably, the original Beza coaxial machine gun was replaced, starting with the 15th vehicle delivered, by the .303 caliber Browning machine gun, which was more readily available in North America. One of the key structural changes was a redesigned nose glacis plate, which was cast as a single piece rather than assembled from multiple parts. This casting method was extended into other sections of the hull and turret, simplifying production and improving structural integrity. Additionally, both variants shared components with the Canadian-built ram tank, further streamlining logistics and manufacturing. The Mark 7 then introduced internal revisions, including the adoption of the British Wireless Set No. 19, which became the standard radio for the Commonwealth armoured units. The subsequent Mark 6A, which entered service in late 1942, featured several external improvements, which includes wider studded tracks for better traction, jettisonable external fuel tanks to extend operational range, an oil cooler to enhance engine performance, and armored covers for the headlights. In total, 1,420 Canadian Valentines were produced. However, despite their solid performance, they were not incorporated into active Canadian armored divisions. Instead, most remained in Great Britain or Canada, serving primarily in training roles. I do have to say, the Valentine with the coax Browning just looks a bit weird.
I kind of fuck with it, bro.
I
don't know. Maybe
I don't know. It's just me. I think it's your like American bias to the Browning.
That's fair. That's fair.
I do like the way that the driver gets into the Valentine. I say he has a hatch on either side of the hull there.
Which pick your poison, Chief.
Pardon?
It's like, pick your poison, Chief. Which side do you want to get in on?
Well, it would make driving, you know, unbuttoned, you know, head out a little annoying, wouldn't it? Because you have to lean to the side, so you're trying to drive, you know, leaning over and ugh.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Like that would just be like, it's like, I want to be able to see properly, but now I have to drive funny, and why? Now my back hurts.
It's like, I have left shoulder straining. Oh, that's not service related.
Yeah, it's like, just you know, each time you turn out, just pick a side. You know, just one to the other, keep the movement going, you'll be fine.
You'll have strain on both sides, you'll be good.
Yeah. Now, for all you Canadians, or people who like Canadian stuff, you can build a Canadian-built early production Mark 6. The only one is done by Mini Art, but it does have all the Canadian parts with it, including, and if you go for this kit as well, it does come with five figures as well as a nice little thing. Although I have a feeling, yeah, it's a Canadian built, but these are Soviet tank figures. So, but I do believe it does have markings for Canadian, but you'll just have to source your own Commonwealth figures for that. So, now we're getting on to the upgunned ones.
Ooh, big boys.
So, first off, we have the Valentine Mark 8. This variant included the AEC diesel engine and a modified turret designed to accommodate the more powerful 6-pounder, or 57mm. However, fitting the larger gun into the existing turret left no room for a coax machine gun, so they just didn't bother with it. Ultimately, the Mark 8 was never put into production, as it was deemed inferior to the more refined and better balanced Mark 9. The Mark 9 was based on the Valentine Mark 5 chassis, but was upgraded with a more powerful 6-pounder gun, similar to the configuration introduced in the Mark 8. To compensate for the increased weight of the larger gun and turret modifications, the side armor was reduced again, following the same pattern seen on the Mark 8. In later productions, an improved version of the GMC 6004 diesel engine was installed, delivering 165 horsepower. This upgrade provided a modest but welcome boost in mobility and overall performance. And you have the Mark 10. This variant introduced a redesigned turret that restored the Baeser coaxial machine gun, which had been omitted from the earlier 6-pounder armed models. The hull construction shifted to welding rather than riveting, improving structural strength and production efficiency. Some units were also fitted with a more powerful 165 horsepower version of the GMC 6004 diesel engine, replacing the earlier 130 horsepower model. And if you want to build one of these, well, you've really only got two options here. You can build a Mark 10 from some weird Russian company, although I have a feeling looking through it they might, I don't know, researching these ones for kits, a lot of them were named wrong, so I omitted a few of them because like they were the sort of smaller, lesser known companies, and they just, yeah, they got like marks wrong and stuff like that. But if you want a decent kit to build of a Mark 9, you have one from Bronco, which would probably be your best bet to go with, you know.
Bronco's a pretty good brand.
That they are. I've got a couple of their kits that I really want to build, including their Comet.
I've only got their M Chaffee, the Korean War variant.
Wasn't that going to be like one of your next builds?
Yeah, but I'm in that stage of modeling where, like, 7 model kits are my next build, so, like, I'm trying to decide what to do.
Yeah, know that feeling, mate. Know that feeling all too well. And the last main variant of the Valentine was the Mark 11. So, this was an upgraded version of the Mark 10. The Mark 11 was equipped with a quick-firing 75mm gun and a more powerful 210 horsepower variant of the GMC 6004 diesel engine, improving both firepower and mobility. It retained welded hull construction and introduced the Canadian-designed cast nose Glacius into British production. Despite its enhancements, the Mark 11 was used exclusively in the Command's tank role and only saw limited service. Although I will say, especially the side profile, the Mark 11 Valentine looks pretty damn cool.
I agree. It's like when you look at a Sherman as Mark, like, 3, like the 75, and then you look at, like, the 76, and this is, like, just upgunned the shit.
Yeah. It almost looks like, say, a Mark 2 got on the gear and just started hitting the gym.
Dude, honestly. Fuck with me now, Germany.
And if you want to build a Mark 11, you got two options again. You have ARC models if you really hate yourself. And you have Bronco with their Mark 11 done up as an OP or a command tank. So you have the extra antenna and stuff like that. I do also like the jerry cans being very nicely placed on the side there.
Very organized, very demeaning.
Yeah. Now we get on to the fun variants. And there's quite a few of them.
The middle
first one. Off, was that?
The middle one, bro. What the fuck?
You'll find out. So first off, we have the Valentine DD. So the Valentine DD, or Duplex Drive, was based on the Valentine 5, 6, and Mark 11. Sorry, forgot Roman numerals there. Okay, Mark 5, 9, and 11. Jesus Christ. Brain, work. Modified to be amphibious using Nicholas Strauss's Duplex Drive system. Metro Camel carried out the conversions, delivering 625 tanks between 1943 and 1944. These amphibious Valentines were primarily used for training crews preparing for the M4 Sherman DD tanks that would participate in the Normandy landings, as well as in training programs in Italy and India. A few Valentine DD tanks were deployed in Italy in 1945, although never used in large numbers during actual combat. The primary reason that they chose the Sherman versus the Valentine for the DD. Well, you can see here in the photo, to deploy these screens, the Valentine has to traverse the turret all the way around because the barrel gets in the way. Whereas the Sherman, it didn't do that. So the Sherman could theoretically fire, shoot its cannon at the same time, although I doubt they really did that. They were probably more focused on not sinking or bailing out.
Let's not take on water, or let's get the fuck out of this metal casket.
Yeah. I will say, I have actually seen one of these in real life. Someone restored one when I went to Tank Fest, and it looks really cool. Next up, we have the Valentine OP, or Command. So the observation post and command vehicles were adapted to serve as artillery observation post and command vehicles. To create more interior space, the main gun was removed and replaced with a dummy barrel mounted in the front of the tank. These vehicles were primarily used by battery commanders and observation posts, especially for archer units, providing vital communication and coordination during operations. This middle one here you pointed out, Garrison, that is a Valentine CDL. So that is it's a canal defense light. Was a continuation of experiments with searchlight-equipped tanks designed to eliminate enemy positions during night attacks. The conventional turret was replaced with one containing a powerful searchlight, allowing the tank to project light across a wide area. This modification was intended in operations in the European theater, such as where such illumination could help infantry advance during nighttime operations. When they actually landed with these CDLs, they were kept so much a secret, right, that they were deployed and never used because they didn't want the Germans to find out about them. Yeah, even the other tankers didn't know what these were. Like they weren't allowed to tell anyone what they were. It's like it's just got a light in it.
Yeah, it's not that special, Chief. Like I get it, it's cool, it's exciting, but like
I think it was like had like a million candle light or something like that. It was like really bright. Lastly, for this page, we have the Valentine Scorpion 2. Was a mine flail vehicle designed to clear paths through minefields. This turretless version of the Valentine featured a flail attachment on the front, which could detonate mines safely while the vehicle passes over them. However, the Scorpion 2 was never used operationally, remaining a prototype tank that was not deployed. Does look very cool, though.
It does, yes. Yes. Just like the
CDL. Oh, yeah. Up next, we have the Valentine Armra Mark 1B. This was equipped with a armored mine roller attachment intended for clearing mines. A few of these vehicles were used during the D-Day landings on Normandy, helping to clear paths for advancing infantry and tanks. We have the Valentine Snake, which is this one here. This was another mine clearing vehicle that used the Snake Line charge system, which involved a long explosive charge designed to clear mines over a wide area. A few of these vehicles were deployed operationally to clear minefields, but their use was very limited. We have the Valentine Bridge Layer. It was a specialized vehicle used for laying bridges across gaps in the battlefield. This turretless Mark II model was fitted with a 10-meter long Class 30 scissors bridge, capable of bearing 30 tons. A total of 192 units were produced, with 25 supplied to the Soviets. The Valentine Bridge Layer saw action in Italy, Burma, Northwest Europe, Manchuria, providing available combat operations with river crossings and other obstacles. The one down at the bottom, which I think looks really cool, is the Valentine with 6-pounder anti-tank mounting. This is an experimental variant. The Valentine with a 6-pounder anti-tank gun was designed to explore the possibility of creating a simple tank destroyer by mounting the 6-pounder's field carriage directly into the hull in place of the turret. Trials were conducted in 1942, but the concept was ultimately deemed unnecessary, as the Valentine could be fitted with a 6-pounder in its turret, making the design somewhat redundant. It does look cool, though. We have 3 flamethrowing Valentines. The last one is just uber cool, but first off, 2 Valentine tanks were modified with petroleum warfare department. Modified by the Petroleum Warfare Department. Just let that sink in. The Petroleum Warfare Department. It's an entire department just for flamethrowers.
I love that.
So they were used modified by the Petroleum Warfare Department to carry flamethrowers as part of trials to determine the most effective tank-mounted flame projector system. One version used a projector powered by slow-burning cordite charges, while the other was designed by AEC and used compressed hydrogen gas. Both vehicles carried their fuel in a trailer, with a flame projector mounted in the front hull. Trials began in 1942, and the gas-operated system was found to be the more effective. This test installation laid the groundwork for the Churchill Crocodile Flamethrower, which saw widespread use. On the top is the cordite, on the bottom is the hydrogen gas one, both of them looking really cool.
I think,
what up?
It kind of, okay, so I was looking at the picture at the bottom right? And
this one?
Yeah, that cloud kind of looks like, I forgot what it's called, the impact there. Kind of looks like one of those Egyptian-like lion statues.
A sphinx?
I don't... yes, that thing. I'm not going to
butcher it. A little bit.
I just looked at it and I was like, is that... No, that's a mortar impact.
Well, we can talk about this little picture here. I think you will like this one.
Do tell.
It is the Valentine 9.75-inch flame mortar.
Okay.
It was an experimental vehicle fitted with a fixed heavy mortar in place of the turret. This vehicle was designed to fire 25-pound TNT incendiary shells to destroy concrete fortifications and other strong points. Trials took place in 43 and 45, although effective in clearing buildings, no kidding, only a few were used during the Normandy landings and D-Day.
Oh.
Yeah, I think we can say 25 pounds of incendiary TNT would definitely be fairly effective at destroying buildings. Wouldn't you say?
That would do the trick.
Yeah, it would probably do the trick, wouldn't it? Especially the whole incendiary part, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine being one of the Germans holed up in a blockhouse. And then just suddenly the one next to you simultaneously explodes and catches on fire.
I wouldn't know what to do.
I really want to retreat now.
Like, I really want to get the fuck out of here.
And as I said, the very last one of these sub-variants is Crackhead Energy. But first we have the Burmac. Was a concept for a light ramp tank designed using the Valentine hull. It was intended for use in the Far East, specifically for crossing difficult terrain and obstacles. However, by the end of the war, brought a halt to its development and the project was nearly fully realized. This is the same concept as the Churchill Arc, where it was basically the Churchill turned into a bridge sort of thing. And lastly, the Crackhead. The Gap Jumping Tank. Just let that sink in.
Oh, Christ, that's...
Towards the end of the war, experimental tests were conducted to develop a Valentine tank capable of crossing obstacles like minefields using rocket propulsion. These experiments were aimed at developing a gap-jumping tank that could leap over obstacles. But the project was not pursued beyond the experimental stage. However, we do have a prototype right here.
That is correct.
I mean, a tank that is designed to be fired up into the air to go over things.
Right, I would not want to be in that.
Oh, that. Oh, I would love to see it, but God, it'd be terrifying to be around.
Imagine you're the crew, right? And you're like, all right, we're gonna pop this shit. You pop it, you land, and now you all have broken backs.
Yeah, now you're like, hey, my spine doesn't work anymore.
You have essentially disabled your own tank. And the crew.
Imagine being the Germans. Have a tank, it's like, they're about to hit our minefield, and it flies up and over you, so going, what the fuck?
I'd be very confused.
They're now launching tanks at us.
It's like, how do you combat that?
It's like, they're coming, get out the flak panzers.
Honestly, dude, fuck.
Skeet shooting tanks. There are two main variants that we need to talk about before we end this. The first one is the Ordnance quick-firing 25-pounder on Carrier Valentine 25-pounder Mark 1 Bishop. Yes, that is an official name for the Bishop SPG.
And you guys say that our fucking names are hard.
Well, I mean, at least it spells it out nicely, and it's not like M1, M2.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, the fast-paced mobile warfare of the North African campaign highlighted the British Army's urgent need for a self-propelled artillery platform equipped with the standard 25-pounder gun howitzer, also known as my favorite gun. To address this, in June 1941, the War Office tasked the Birmingham Railway Carriage and Wagon Company with developing such a vehicle. A prototype was completed and ready for trials by August of that year, demonstrating the rapid pace of development. By November 1941, an initial production order for 100 vehicles had been placed. The resulting design was built on the reliable Valentine II infantry tank chassis, but instead of a rotating turret, it featured a fixed, tall, boxy superstructure to house the gun crew and mount the artillery piece. This distinctive structure, reminiscent of a bishop's mitre, and the vehicle is an unofficial nickname, the Bishop. Also, quick note here. Right up to about the 90s or so, all British self-propelled guns had a religious name. So you have bishop, archer, priest, abbot, sexton, deacon, all of that kind of stuff. So that was just a weird thing they had with all their self-propelled guns, had a religious name to it. Mounted inside the superstructure was the quick-firing 25-pounder gun howitzer, the British Army's primary field artillery piece. However, due to the constraints of the enclosed mount, the gun's elevation was limited to just 15 degrees, significantly less than the towed version, and as a result, its maximum range was reduced to about 6,400 yards, roughly half of what was normally achievable. This limitation was a serious disadvantage, particularly in the wide-open terrain of desert warfare. To compensate, crews often constructed earthen ramps and drove the Bishop onto them, tilting the vehicle backwards to artificially increase the gun's elevation and extend its effective range. The Bishop also had restricted gun traverse, only 8 degrees to either side, and a maximum depression of 5 degrees. In addition to the main armament, it carried a Bren light machine gun for close defense. Production ramped up quickly, and by July 1942, 80 bishops had been completed. As the final 20 of the initial batch were underway, a follow-up order for 50 more units was placed, with an option for an additional 200. However, that larger order was ultimately cancelled in favour of adopting the American-built M7 Priest, which mounted a 105mm howitzer and offered superior performance, especially in range and mobility. Interestingly, despite its limitation and relatively short service life in British hands, the Bishop was exported. Turkey received 48 units in 1943, which means that it's ended up being used in the Western Desert. I kind of like the Bishop, even though it has its faults. It's a cool-looking self-propelled gun.
Very.
If you want to build one of these, well, you have four options, or four decent options. Three of them in 35th and one in 72nd. The 72nd scale one is from Italeri. We also have two from Bronco, with one of them being a special edition, which includes the number 27 ammunition limber towed behind it. As well, from the Dragon Imperial series, we have the, they just call it British Bishop self-propelled gun, but you know what it is. And lastly, we have the SP 17-pounder Valentine Mark I Archer, also one of a particular favorite of this podcast, well, especially Don. Right, the 17-pounder anti-tank gun was among the most powerful Allied anti-tank weapons in the Second World War. However, its size and weight made it difficult to maneuver on the battlefield without a dedicated towing vehicle. This logistical challenge offered it limited its offensive utility, making it effective as a static defensive weapon rather than a mobile attacking one. To increase the tactical flexibility of the 17-pounder, British engineers explored self-propelled platforms that could carry the gun into battle. An early attempt had been the Churchill 3-inch gun carrier of 1942, but it proved underwhelming and not widely adopted. Meanwhile, United States began supplying the M10 tank destroyer, armed with a 76mm gun, through Lend-Lease, providing a stopgap. Nevertheless, the British sought a homegrown alternative capable of mounting the 17-pounder. Several existing or obsolete tank chassis were considered. The Valentine was favored for its mechanical reliability, low profile, and ongoing production, despite being increasingly outdated as a frontline combat tank. The Crusader was also evaluated due to its favorable power-to-weight ratio. In parallel, entirely new 17-pounder tank designs were in development, including the Cruiser Mark VIII Challenger, derived from the Cromwell, and the Sherman Firefly, a successful British conversion from the American Sherman. Ultimately, the Valentine chassis was selected for a conversion into a self-propelled gun carrier. It was available in large numbers and provided a compact, low silhouette platform suitable for mounting the heavy 17-pounder. However, the compact hull lacked the space for a turret capable of housing such a large weapon. Instead, engineers mounted the gun in a fixed rear-facing open-top armored casemate, creating a configuration visually and conceptually similar to early German Panzerjäger tank destroyers. This configuration gave rise to the vehicle known as the Archer. The gun was mounted facing the rear of the chassis, which allowed for a short vehicle length and better concealment. While unconventional, this arrangement had tactical advantages. After firing, the Archer could immediately retreat without turning around, making it ideal for hit-and-run ambush tactics. The mounting offered 11 degrees of traverse to either side and elevation from -7.3 to +15. Inside, the layout was very tight. When the gun fired, the breech recoiled close to the driver's position, yet the driver remained in place, ready to move the vehicle quickly if needed. Which also must be terrifying when it's being fired, yeah. And the gun breech is literally recoiling to within inches of your spine.
Yeah, it's a little sketch.
Yeah. Talk about stressful. Compared to the standard Valentine, the Archer was also fitted with a more powerful engine to better handle the added weight and stress of the 17-pounder. The first prototype of the Archer was completed in 1943, and initial firing trials were conducted in April of that year. Impressed with its potential, the British government placed an order for Vickers with 800 vehicles, marking the Archer's transition from an experimental design to a vital component in Britain's evolving anti-tank doctrine. And if you want to build one of these weird tank destroyers, well, you have three to choose from. Of course, you have the excellent Tamiya Archer, which still goes for a very hefty price nowadays, I got to say. Every time I find one, it's like $120 plus. You have Bronco with their self-propelled gun, Archer, as well as Accurate Miniatures also have a Archer in 35th scale. And that is it. that is all we have for the Valentine Tank series. We're just going to go into a brief intermission now, then we will be back with hobby news and works in progress. And we are back with the hobby news, and let's get through this. First off, from IBG, we have a Focke-Wulf FW190 D9 or Dora 9. This is the Mimetal variant, which has a broader tail. Coming out in 72nd scale, if you are into Focke-Wulfs, definitely look out for this one. The D9s are my favorite Focke-Wulf, so I wouldn't mind getting one myself. From Dora Wings, we are getting a Fairy Delta 2. This is coming in 48 scale. At the moment, no box art or anything like that. We just have a built-up test shot, but the Delta 2 is a pretty cool early 1950s jet. From ICM, we are getting Fire Trucks of Ukraine. This is a reboxing model set. Two representatives of the fire truck class, the AC-40-137A tank truck and the AR-2 hose truck.
Nice.
If you're into that kind of stuff, one to look out for, I think they look really cool. From IBG again, in 35th scale, we are getting a Panzer II Alps A1, the very first type of the light tank of the Panzer II variant. This is coming with a special edition. Unfortunately, I have no idea what that includes. I tried to find information about it, couldn't find anything. So if anyone knows what that special edition is going to mean, please let us know. Wouldn't mind having one, though. It does look cool.
It does look cool, and I love the track sack.
Yeah, and the little bar, the suspension bar and stuff like that. I think it's also slightly shorter as well.
Itty-bitty guy.
Yeah. Up next, from Hobby 2000, we have a reboxing of a Yokosuka E14Y1 Model 11 Early. This is an old Fujimi kit that they are re-releasing in a new boxing, and I think there might be new decals for it. Either way, very cool-looking aircraft, Japanese, of course, coming out in 72nd scale. From Border Models, in 35th scale, we're getting a Stug 3 Alps G variant, early production with a full interior. Kit also will be coming with four figures as well. I think Garrison, you and Clint would really like to have this one, I think.
I was about to say, yeah, Clint and I both would absolutely enjoy this kit.
I mean, the full interior would be pretty cool. You wouldn't see much of it, but still, you know.
I think I'd have to do, like, you definitely have to do the interior up, and depending on the figures, have the figures inside, and then take shots of them, and then have, like, pictures of it next to your display.
Yeah. I mean, you could probably build it, depending on how they've designed the kit, you could probably have the entire top hull, like, not glued down, so you can lift it off to see inside.
Oh, yeah, kind of like my 113 I've got.
Yeah, like that.
Solid idea.
From Edward, we are getting a re-release with new decals for the L-29 Delphin. This is coming with Czech decals and a very cool black and yellow tiger stripe camouflage scheme in 172nd, the L-29 Delphine being a trainer jet, two-seater. Gecko Models, more of their Vietnam stuff. We have 60-70 Saigon street fruit and vegetable vendor set, as well as the U.S. Army temporary dormitories in Vietnam war era, which is basically just shipping containers with bunks in them. Very cool.
Nice.
PACOM, 100% new tooling in 35th scale of the Yag Tiger with Henschel production type, with a full interior, which I really, really would like, because I really, really like the Yag Tiger. Full interior as well would be pretty cool to do, even if no one will see it, but again, you could probably, it might build up in a way that you can also take the top off or something so you can see inside. If not, I mean, even if they did like a clear, you know how on this box that they're showing the, like, a cutaway? If they did like a clear part for the side, it would be pretty cool.
That would be pretty neat.
Just make it an option. From Meng, ooh, in 72nd scale, we are getting the Russian main battle tank, the T-72B3M. Don't know much about Soviet modern tanks, so Garrison, I believe this is one you wouldn't mind, even though it's in 72nd scale.
Oh, god damn it. Yeah. I'd probably give it a shot, even though it's 72nd.
Yeah. 72nd Arm is not that bad. I've been doing that a bit, and it's a little bit of joy to it. It's not as like involved as 35th. This one's for you though. Trumpeter releasing a brand new German Leopard 2 A6 MBT in 16th scale. That would be massive.
God, Trumpeter is doing 16th scale shit now?
Oh, they've been doing 16th scale for a long time. They love their big scales.
Where have I been?
I don't know. Deployed?
I ain't been deployed in years, homie.
But if you're into the 16th scale and really like spending a lot of money on paint, that'll be one for you to look out for.
That's so valid. That thing would be massive.
Oh, no, right?
Imagine weathering that. No thanks.
It would take a while.
Yeah, it would.
MiniArt bringing out another of the RSOs. This is the Feldkuss Ulf RSO /01. Don't know how to pronounce that or what that means, but basically it's a field kitchen, I think, which is kind of cool. Does look really cool. It looks way too short. It looks like it's going to tip over backwards or forward.
I need this for an HIDF build, bro.
Yeah, the RSOs are pretty cool looking tracked vehicles. There is one that has a 75mm cannon on it.
Oh my god, I want that.
Yeah. I was also watching Australian modeler Clayton Knocker be building up one for their 48 and 48, and yeah, they look like really good kits as well, like full interior and detailed engines.
Okay.
And from I Love Kit in 350 scale, we have a USS Stevens DD479. This is a Fletcher-class destroyer. In 1350 scale, don't know too much about this one, but I like the Fletcher destroyers. So, funnily enough, you know the movie Greyhound with Tom Hanks?
Yep.
They use a Fletcher destroyer in that. That's what it is. You want to know the ironic thing is?
What's that?
Fletchers were deployed to the Pacific, not to the Atlantic. So they got that bit wrong.
With Tom Hanks, they would have gotten that right. Come on.
I think it's more they wanted to use an actual destroyer, and that's all they had. So I appreciate the fact they used a real destroyer, not a CGI and all of that. So I'll give them credit.
Yeah,
for that.
That's fair. Yeah.
And that's it for the hobby news. Some very good looking releases there. A few I wouldn't mind having myself.
Agreed.
We'll just crack on straight into the works in progress. Garrison, take it away.
All right, so I got a couple slides here. The first one is my Ukrainian M113. This is it's a full interior kit, but I didn't do the engine bay just because I had no desire to. But the back of this thing is very busy, lots of equipment, gear. And then the outside is a two-tone camo. Added some antennas, little photo etch. It's supposed to be a photo etch grill, but I converted it to be like a 50 cal ammo holder. You can kind of see it. And
Yeah, very nice. I love the interior.
Thank you. Next is my Trumpeter T64, which during the podcast I have started weathering with oil paints. Using the 502 oils, I used their light mud, ABT125, and it looks a lot better than the pictures with some weathering on it. But yeah, this is done up as a Ukrainian tank, added a Ukrainian flag, and then painted the flag on to the barrel, a couple pluses. And yeah, the crew's all set as well, so all I gotta do is finish weathering it and then add the infantry and the fucking camo netting to the barrel. We'll be set.
Nice. It's looking really good, man. Looking real cool.
Thank you. Speaking of the infantry, here's the fire team of Ukrainian infantrymen that'll be on the tank, plus another Ukrainian who will be dragging a box of ammo out of the 113 as the tank goes by. And then the top right, you've got the Foreign Legion fighters who will be scattered about in a trench area, taking pictures of the tank going by. And then next, like we were talking about earlier, I've got a Valentine tank that was gifted to me. And I really want to do a New Zealand Mark III Valentine in the Pacific with infantry going to clear out a bunker. However, in order to do that, I have to get the conversion kit, which is fine. So I've got that shown up there. And then the past couple days, Callum and Don have been helping me do research, finding out about the New Zealand infantry. And they wore U.S. field caps. And I was like, fuck, how am I going to get those? And then I remembered I got some resin USMC figures. And one of them has a field cap. There's another one that has a field cap also, but his head is attached to the body. So I don't know if I'll use that or not. But in my search for figures, I found the perfect poses, except they're British infantry in Normandy. So some conversions will need to happen, but I think I'm going to go with those.
Very cool. Can't wait to see what you do with that, because I know I ended up going on a bit of a deep dive rabbit hole on New Zealand 3rd Division and stuff like that.
I'm very excited, not going to lie.
I got to say, some of the photos that I found were pretty damn cool.
Yes. Oh, yeah. The pictures you sent in the player's manual. Yeah. Very nice.
I've just got four whips. First off, this is my Matchbox 176 scale SDKFZ124 Wesp, the self-propelled gun based on the Panzer II chassis. This was done as part of the Auckland IPMS Roy Huxley challenge build. I did that base in a day. Nice. So that's why I've been doing a lot of 76 and 72nd stuff. It's just I'm finding it easier to make simple bases for them. So yeah, bit of practice.
Well, it looks good.
Yeah, thank you. It turned out better than I thought it would. Next, I built a Tamiya Kawanishi. It's called a George. It's got a long complex. Oh, it's the hang on. The Kawanishi N1K1JA Shiden Type 11. Allies called it George, so I'm calling it George.
George. George it is.
Yeah. This was just a 3-day build, quick little mojo thing, so it's not like the best. Tamiya decals suck. Most of them silvered on me, but learned my lesson. Never going to use Tamiya decals again. Jesus. Other than that, it's a very cool looking aircraft. It looks similar to the P-47 Thunderbolt, so it's kind of like the Japanese Thunderbolt. And turns out, for a land-based fighter, it was actually really good as well. So
Nice. Oh my god.
Current work in progress. This is a Heller 1-400 Type 39 torpedo boat, also known as the Albing class destroyer. For a Heller kit, it's actually going together really well. So I've got it all built up and started to do the painting. So first off was, of course, the hull. So you got the upper hull gray, hull red, anti-fouling, and then, of course, the boot strap, which, thankfully, on the Heller kit, was actually two raised lines to demarcate the boot where the boot strap goes. So, and I just happened to have masking tape that fit just between the two raised lines for it. So that actually helped out quite a lot. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So apart from that, it's just a sort of test build for building larger scale ships. And so it's fairly basic, but I'm going to start once I get the rest of the upper structures and citadel and stuff like that. Once that's all painted up, then I've got to start masking off for the three-tone camouflage splinter, which is going to look really cool. The only thing I'm not going to do is add the rails, the side rails to it, because they are so massively overscale and thick that it just take away from it.
Fair.
And lastly, this is what I'm going to be working on after we've finished recording here. This is a Mother's Day present, because it's Mother's Day here in New Zealand. And I've spent the last 15 hours printing off this large-scale NASA astronaut with the MMU. There's the photo of the astronaut, and he's got the big backpack, and he's just floating off by himself?
Yep.
Yeah, it's that. So
that's a lot of trust to put into something when you could just be lost in space forever.
Oh yeah. So this is actually for scale. It is. I've managed to print it off. 100 millimeters high, which is about 4 inches. So it's about 4 inches by 2 inches. 4 inches, 2 inches, and 3 inches. So it's fairly large. It took about 15 hours. But it's pretty cool. It's going to be pretty easy to paint up by the end of the day. So, and that's going to be my present to her, because she really likes it when I build space stuff, because she really likes space stuff. So she has a space nook, we call it.
Hell yeah.
Has all this stuff, so yeah. And that is it. That is it for the Valentine episode. But of course, since we have come to the end of our episode, we have the last thing to do, is that is to thank our Patreon supporters. For our Pinju supporters, we have Paul Gallagher, Lord Floki, Robert Judson, Brel Mastroni, and Liam Barnett, and our Pinju follower, Robert Brisbane. You guys help keep the lights on around here, and we always give a big shout out to you guys, because you guys are amazing. Of course, I'd also like to give Liam another big shout out, because he sent me the B25 and the EZ8 kits as well. So big shout out to you.
Yeah.
Found a few more things to print off for you, so I'll be sending those to you very soon. And that's it. That is all we have for this episode. So the last thing we have to do is, of course, thank you for watching and supporting us. And if you have made it this far, we'd like to thank you for, you know, putting up with us. I know there's been a few big breaks recently, but, you know, life gets in the way. But we'll try and do it as often as we can. Also, you'll notice that the... make sure it's still, no, we're still good. Also, you'll have noticed a strange new episode, not called Micro Machines Podcast, just before this episode. That is Duds of War. That is our brand new podcast that we are starting as a sort of supplement to the Micro Machines Podcast, because of course we do like talking about military things quite a bit. I think we can safely say that, eh, Garrison?
I would say so.
Yeah, and what's our most favorite thing to talk about? The really shit things.
The fucked up food market.
Oh, yeah, they've always been the funniest episodes when it's been a really fucked up vehicle. Shillelagh, we'll say that. So, Duds of War will be solely focusing on the worst of the worst when it comes to weapons, vehicles, stuff like that, throughout military history. Not modeling related at all. It's just going through audio only, and it's just going to be us going through the history of the worst of the worst and taking the piss out of them, basically. So it will have its own feed and everything like that. Still getting all of that sorted out, but that episode will be on this feed just as a promo as well until we get everything else sorted out. So I hope you guys check that out and support that as well. But that is all we have. So if you have managed to watch and listen, thank you for supporting us for this long, 4 long years so far, and still going strong. We will see you guys in the next episode. Bye for now.
Deuces.